Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again, our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Thanks again to all of our listeners. Truly grateful and humbled by how many people follow our program. And if I haven't gotten back to you, I'll give you my contact information. I try to get back to as many people as possible. A lot of you guys ask, like, sometimes how I come up with the titles for some of the episodes, and I usually take them from different lines or titles from different very Springsteen music. So a lot of people have asked, like, where I come up with things like Streets of Fire, Racing in the Streets. So those of you guys who follow the program know my affinity towards Bruce Springsteen, who hopefully one day I will have the opportunity to meet and sit down and have a cocktail with him. So as you know, I do this program organically. Julie just recently is like, can you please sometime during the week just write something down that you're going to talk about? That's just not how my mind works. So today we're going to talk about anxiety. And anxiety and depression are typically considered the common colds of mental illness. And this is something that I confront on a daily basis with patients doing diagnostics. Anxiety in and of itself is not necessarily a pathological state. You know, part of our autonomic nervous system, the fight or flight response. Anxiety does serve a purpose in helping us to maintain our survival, maintain a level of awareness, but it does cross into a threshold where it does become pathological. And there's various types of anxiety disorders. There's generalized anxiety disorder, separation anxiety disorder, social phobia, which used to be called social anxiety disorder. So anxiety really impacts, I think, across the lifespan. Now, I generally do diagnostics from age 6 to 106, whatever. And invariably, people all endorse, when I ask about different symptoms, it always endorses, yeah, I'm anxious. And people a lot of times have a really hard time pinpointing, especially when you're getting into generalized anxiety, what exactly causes that heightened state of arousal, because it can become incapacitating, even leading to a state of another diagnosis of agoraphobia, refusal to leave your home. So it seems very, like, an innocuous term, like, I'm anxious. And there's some things that, you know, are situationally anxiety provoking. You know, giving a speech in public is the most common phobia. Actually, the most common phobia is, our common fear is fear of snakes. But I think the phobia is public speaking. You know, going on a job interview, going on a first date, meeting your potential in-laws for the first time. All of these things, I think, are naturally anxiety-provoking, because anxiety has a lot to do with unfamiliarity and unpredictability. And as individuals, when we feel that we don't have a perceived sense of control over the outcomes or the actions or lack thereof of other individuals, it can produce an elevated level of anxiety that can become incapacitating, to the point where it can lead to self-loathing, self-denigration. And then you that's where you see the manifestation of depression, and they're linked very much together. I don't see many cases where anxiety and depression are not, what we should say, is comorbid, coexisting together. And I can't tell you how many people, they want the magic pill. They want the class of medications called the benzodiazepines. They want the Xanax. They want Clonopin. They want Ativan. people generally don't ask for other ones like Vistaril or Buspar, but there's this over reliance, I think, in Western society for the magic pill. And I can't tell you, from working in mental health for a long time, how many people I've just heard from, you know, talking to secretaries and talking to prescribers, just hearing, you know, without intentionally, everybody loses their benzodiazepines and everybody loses their ADHD medications. They don't lose their mood stabilizers. They don't lose their antidepressants. They don't lose their sleeping medication, but they always lose the controlled substances. So just as an aside from my experience of just hearing things over the years, it's interesting that you know, and the medications do work, but they work as they need to work in conjunction with cognitive behavioral therapy to really kind of get a grasp on what is causing this heightened state of arousal. And there's something called anticipatory anxiety. Perfect example is, like, you know, you're going on, like, again, on a job interview, and you're worried for the last, you know, the 5 days leading up to it. Again, is that situationally based? Yes. But can it lead to something more catastrophic and in a much broader sense, where it's really impacting life in general? And anxiety can contribute to elevated levels of stress, which will result in elevated cortisol levels. You can put on extra weight. It could lead to cardiovascular problems. It could lead to, you know, we have anxiety that has, there's physical symptoms of sweaty palms, of, you know, then you get into like panic, and panic attacks are the most common cause of emergency room visits because they mimic cardiac symptoms. And panic attacks generally last about 10 minutes, but for an individual experiencing a panic attack, it feels like they're in this hole that they cannot get out of. It almost feels like they're in it for hours. So anxiety can be incredibly debilitating on an individual's life. And it could also be debilitating and it impact relationships. If you're constantly in a relationship with somebody and they need constant reassurance, and I'm not talking necessarily about the personality disorders like borderline or dependent personality disorder, but, you know, anxiety, you know, the physiological part is, you know, you have elevated glutamate levels are exacerbated or elevated in the body, contributing to this heightened state of arousal. And that's why people like the benzodiazepines, because it releases GABA, which is the inhibitory neurotransmitter. So, you know, I mean, think about just, I was reading an article in the news, and it just came to me where I felt a state of anxiety, you know, with the atrocities going on in Ukraine. I'm flipping along and an article comes up, 47 ways how to survive a nuclear bomb. And I'm sitting here thinking, it's 2022 and I'm reading this and trying to pay attention to what I'm actually reading, not out of just a curiosity. It's like, holy cow, I'm actually reading an article about what to do if a nuclear bomb were to be sent off to the United States. And at that moment, I did feel a sense of anxiety. So I think, again, there's those situations. That's a scary thing to think about. I think all of us in the world are on the edge of our seats. And I've had a lot of people recently who've had a lot of patients who've had a lot of anxiety, who have families that live on the other side of the world from the United States that are much more close proximity to what's going on in Ukraine. So I think a lot of people are feeling this intense level of anxiety, and also this level of hopelessness and helplessness, which also kind of comes along as part of the emotional baggage in dealing with anxiety, because it really impacts how an individual functions. And it again, if it's situationally based, that's a little easier to deal with, because you can kind of pinpoint, and from a therapeutic standpoint, you can kind of work, you can do you know, what's called like in vivo role play, have the patient practice, you know, what would you say on a job interview? So you're kind of building up that skill set. Exposure therapy is another technique for anxiety. It's really good for phobias, but you really need to know how to do exposure therapy. Again, like I said, it's good for the phobias. But anxiety in and of itself, I think it's one of those other terms that gets tossed around so much. But I'm just trying to really come across with the perspective of how impactful an anxiety disorder truly is when you're meeting the diagnostic criteria for one. And I know Julie confronts this on a daily basis. And it's associated with a vast majority of psychiatric conditions. And sometimes it borders on complete irrationality, where it's like, what, really, you're anxious about this? And people, they become almost paralyzed, and they spend way too much time in their minds. And that's the worst place for any of us to be, is in our own heads, because we second guess. And sometimes, the night vultures, as Julie says, they come when laying at night. So a lot of times one of the assessments I use when I talk about sleep is like, are there any other issues at night that are impacting your sleep? And patients will a lot of times write, my mind won't shut off. And it's not from like a bipolar perspective. It's from, I have bills to pay. Is my partner faithful? Am I a good enough spouse? And even the kids, am I going to do well on the test? Are mom and dad going to be mad at me for doing this? There's so much this what if thinking, and almost a catastrophic quality to it. That again, that's where sometimes it borders on irrationality. But again, it's important to kind of parse out, is like, if you're anxious, step back and saying, if I'm having anxiety about X, is it pretty natural? And I kind of use what's called like the reasonable person hypothesis. Something I made up. It's if you're in a given situation and you feel a certain, we'll stick with anxiety, you feel anxiety, step back and say, what would a reasonable person do in this situation? So like I said, we'll take public speaking for an example. Obviously, I would have no problem getting up and speaking in front of people. I'm much more of an extrovert. Julie, I think, is being much more of an introvert, wouldn't be like that. Neither bad nor good. But if you're in a situation, say, most people would feel anxious giving a speech in front of other people, giving a speech to your colleagues, giving a speech to your class, if you're in school. So, but other times, when it becomes so pervasive in a person's life where they become anxious over everything, and the anxiety is always associated with these worst case scenarios. And that feeling of not having control is really scary. I'm not saying you need to be a controlling person, that you need to be a type A anal individual, but walking around with this constant state of heightened arousal and heightened hypersensitivity to things that are going on in your life or going on in the lives of your children, your colleagues, your friends, whatever, your individual job. It's a really a pervasive situation. I'm sticking along with really generalized anxiety disorder right now. But if you walk around with this generalized state, you're constantly in the hyper state of arousal, and it's associated sometimes with substance abuse to try to mute the symptoms of it. If you're not on being prescribed medication, it could lead to a variety of maladaptive behaviors, like it was called excoriation disorder, which is like skin picking disorder. That's a lot of people with heightened anxiety will pick their skin, they'll bite their lip. OCD falls into the anxiety disorders. That's a more severe form, but that's all about control. And so, with OCD is I can't take the hand washer. I can't control my emotions, but I can't control how many times I wash my hands. So anxiety has this broad, I hate this term spectrum, but it has this broad spectrum where it can be situationally based, it can be generalized, and it can also be at a level where it is completely incapacitating and debilitating, because it's all about outcome. It's all about unpredictability, and there's the fear associated with it. We don't become anxious about things that are going to have a positive outcome. If you're anxious walking down the aisle, getting married, I think that's kind of like you say, like the butterflies, unless you're walking down the aisle and you're like, oh geez, what am I doing here? And that anxiety is like, oh, it's kind of too late to make this decision. A little different, but you know, I think when it overtakes you and it becomes part of the psychological infrastructure that you navigate with on a daily basis, that's really when you want to get into therapy, talk to your primary care, talk to a prescriber. And again, the medications help, but they don't, same with like the ADHD meds. They will help anybody concentrate, but it doesn't teach the skills. The anti-anxiety medications, they will help assuage the anxiety, but it doesn't give anybody the coping skills of how to do it. And cognitive therapy has so many interventions and techniques to really reduce the level of anxiety or subjectively felt level of distress that a person is feeling. And, you know, uncontrolled anxiety almost invariably leads to depression. Because people can't get out of their own minds. They can't get out of their own way. They can't get out of their own heads, and it becomes almost a degree of toxicity. And especially when you factor generalizing this disorder with panic, that's when you're getting all those physiological symptoms. And they're, you know, from patients' report, they are incredibly scary. You know, a lot of the assessments that I use in diagnostics, we, you know, assess for a variety of different anxiety disorders, and sometimes people's responses are just off the charts. You know, the hysteria scale on the MMPI, you get into like hypochondriasis, which is that's in the different category of what we call like the somatoform disorders or the conversion disorders, where people have this, you know, this heightened sense of dread that something physiological is wrong with them, when in reality all medical evidence says there is nothing wrong. That's a whole different topic in and of itself, the conversion disorders and the somatoform disorders, but the factitious disorders are interesting as well. That's when you're getting into like Munchausen by proxy, stuff like that. So I really wanted to shed light on anxiety because it is incredibly common. And even from talking with people on an international level, I can't think of a conversation where this word hasn't come out of someone's mouth, whether it relates to them or somebody that's in their inner circle or somebody that they know or a family member. But as I said earlier, anxiety in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's part of our fight or flight response. It's when it becomes pathological and it becomes almost self-destructive and is affecting your ability to work, your ability to function in your relationship, your ability to navigate the social world. That's when you really want to step back and say, look, I need to get into therapy. I need to get into treatment to try to deal with this, because such a strong association between anxiety and depression, it can, just like depression, it can come in and just overtake you, just like that. Same as with depression. Did you want to?
Sure.
Oh, and here she is.
Hi, everyone. I was listening, and you know, we were talking about what we really wanted to talk about today, and I thought it was probably, you know, listening to what Corey was saying about initially when he started talking about anxiety. Oh, God, where do I start? Well, he did talk a little bit about controlled substances, benzodiazepines and all that. Benzodiazepines, they work. They work to help someone. Well, first, let me just start by saying how to treat anxiety from a medication perspective and really kind of loop around and tie in to the importance of cognitive behavioral therapy, healing, and actually developing the skills to do the work. In my experience, on a professional level, I don't think it's very rare. It's probably 2% of my patients, overall 2% of my patients in my whole career thus far would not have uttered the word anxiety. That's how prevalent it is. When treating anxiety with medication can be enormously helpful. Anxiety looks like a lot of different things, but it's definitely an internal struggle. It's in the mind. It feels like it's in your entire body. and sometimes it stays with you constantly, and sometimes it comes and goes. And sometimes when it comes, it can be unbearable. And it can lead to, you know, severe anxiety disorders, such as like the fictitious disorders, somatoform disorders, OCD, and severe panic disorder, where, like Cor said, people wind up in the emergency rooms with panicking, and, you know, they wind up getting like IV Ativan because, you know, panic symptoms, you know, they mimic cardiac symptoms. So people feel very often like they're having a heart attack. But what the medications do, and I do have a few favorites, and just to say again, as a prescriber, it really comes down to what that particular prescriber, because we're all different people. There's no real protocol. So people are basically, who are prescribing, are pretty much, and I could say this is probably a very safe assumption, they use what they've seen work for their own patients. And I can say that with, you know, a fair amount of confidence, which would make sense. In my practice, I feel like if I have a patient, and probably now there are very few people who seek benzodiazepines. A lot of people don't even know what they are. And a lot of people are taking them, and they're taking them responsibly. And a lot of people have them, and they're fearful of using them because they know how addictive they can be. But whether it's a benzodiazepine, which they were originally invented, you know, they kind of hailed from the barbiturate family. They nip severe anxiety in the bud, when it's like an episode. What happens is, the plan, I believe, was that it was so, if you get a patient that's super, super anxious and you just want to help them yesterday, which, let's face it, that's the way healthcare works, you would start someone on an antidepressant medication like Zoloft, Celexa, sertraline, citalopram. I try to mention both names because what you get on your bottle is never the trade, unless the medication itself has not gone generic. So you're getting the trade name. Example of that would be Trintellix, which is an antidepressant. one of the newer antidepressants. But so the benzos were originally designed to help people cope until that antidepressant, whether it's an SSRI at the lower doses, can treat generalized anxiety, social phobia, agoraphobia, panic disorder, OCD, you need higher doses of an SSRI or an SNRI. But because it takes a little while for them to work, and initially benzodiazepines were supposed to provide some relief until the dose could be titrated of the SSRI or SNRI. And then the plan typically is to taper someone off. So it's sort of like this, it's kind of a rhythm in prescribing. The real takeaway message I want to say is that that anxiety is debilitating. It truly is debilitating. It's exhausting. It's not only exhausting in, you know, it completely, it's very distracting, preoccupying. It's a joy stealer for sure. It steals happiness. It steals joy. Although Deepak Chopra said recently on Reels, I think it was, someone was interviewing him and he was talking about, happiness is a state where you are, you know, celebrating something, something's happened and you're happy about it. Joy is a state that you feel anyway without an event. Anxiety is a total joy stealer, just like depression. It, like I said, debilitating. But I think the medication piece for anxiety is very much an important discussion to have. If you really are struggling with anxiety and you know that you don't have a, you know, any kind of bipolarity going on, you know, it's protocol to start somebody on an antidepressant. The goal being that this antidepressant, which technically is trying to rein in the amygdala and treat the brain in the neurotransmission of norepinephrine and serotonin, that takes time, but it doesn't take that long, really. It usually will take a couple weeks sometimes. But what happens is that people report to me that, wow, like they almost recognize it in hindsight. And and this is why people don't like sometimes very high doses of SSRIs or SNRIs, because they can have a numbing feel to them. They can make people feel, you know, emotionally detached from life. Unfortunately, that can be one of the downsides of using antidepressants. But what it actually does, ultimately, the goal is that a person is able to not feel, they are able to feel less saturated with anxiety. They feel the goal is to make a person feel as though the anxiety is a little bit more externalized, and more manageable. That is where cognitive behavioral therapy comes in. That is where the full-on treatment comes in, because sometimes people are just too anxious to do the therapy work because they're riddled with anxiety. This is also not just a disease of the mind, and it's a culprit of the mind and the body. The human body, as Cor just described too, the autonomic nervous system and the fight or flight or freeze, or now freeze, is designed to help us survive. However, it can become very debilitating if it's not treated. Some people can find other ways to treat anxiety. It's really basically trying to find ways of healing themselves, be it, you know, meditation, prayer. You know, I'm all for all of that. I mean, it really just depends. Sometimes people will take things over the counter, like, or, you know, herbal remedies. Lavender. And I'm all for that as well. It's just, if you have a predisposition or a genetic, if you're genetically loaded for a bipolar condition, you want to be really careful before taking an antidepressant, because if people who don't have bipolar but carry the gene, it can be activated by an antidepressant. So you really need, ideally, perfect world, you know, get an evaluation, get a neuropsych evaluation. Sometimes it's very straightforward. You know, it really is. We do have cases all the time that are very straightforward. Anxiety is one of the easiest conditions to treat. That's the best news ever, you know, because depression, that's not as easy to treat. You know, people can be depressed, and so much so that, you know, sometimes medication doesn't heal the depression. And sometimes they have to look at alternative methods or adjunct methods of treatment. But that being said, you know, anxiety is real. I think right now, I don't know how you all feel about social media, and what's going on in the world. But it's, for me, it's always been a constant struggle. I do struggle with anxiety. I do believe that I have had some trauma in my life. And I say this only because you know, I don't know that it's helpful for you to know that, but I say it because I feel strongly about, you know, kind of speaking out about it. I don't need to get into details, but I do struggle with it. And I am the kind of person who tries to find ways to find joy. And I try to, in that, you know, the way I do that is spend time with loved ones. I'll go for a walk out in nature. I mean, if I hear the birds, I know, bird lady, I'm okay. It grounds me. You know, sleep is essential. And that's when it's like, you know, when all the lights go off and you're lying in bed, of course, you get a drive-in movie with a blank screen. Of course, you're going to think about. So, you know, that's when all of the demons or brain spiders, you know, show up. But I have really seen antidepressants work. I'm a huge fan of sertraline, Zoloft. I'm just a huge fan of it. I got to tell you, I mean, I certainly am not making any money from the pharmaceutical companies by any means, and nor would I take any money. But I do feel like that is one in particular. Lexapro is escitalopram. It's excellent for anxiety. Again, lower doses. It will take the edge off. The benzodiazepines long-term use now is really, I mean, for the past probably 8 years, maybe 10 years, I think the research came out of United Kingdom, and it really was strongly correlating long-term benzo use with dementia and memory loss. With the pandemic, I feel like people in general, I don't know if anybody out there is noticing that about themselves or with other people, but people, I believe, are suffering from memory loss. Anyway, but benzodiazepines, they work. They quiet the central nervous system and they quiet the brain. So they cross the blood-brain barrier and they're quieting the brain. I mean, it's all GABA. I mean, it's soothing. It's calming. They work. Unfortunately, some work longer than others. And it's really ultimately a Band-Aid because it doesn't fix the problem like antidepressants do. Buspirone is another medication that's a straight up anxiolytic. If you're kind of leery of trying an SSRI or an SNRI, like that would be like an Effexor, a venlafaxine, you know, or a Cymbalta, duloxetine, that's another SNRI. They're both great meds. You know, buspirone, I use very, very often with my patients who have bipolar disorder because I don't want to put them on an antidepressant. And it works wonders. It's straight up an anxiolytic. It doesn't seem to cause much drowsiness. It's pretty specifically targeted for anxiety. It was invented for anxiety and it's non-addictive. So it's perfect for that person that you're working with, or if you know yourself that you do struggle with any kind of an addictive personality and you know that you might be, you know, kind of in danger of that. So basically, you know, for any of the anxiety disorders, you know, you're looking at getting an SSRI or an SNRI on board. I'm not treating anybody on this podcast, of course. I'm just trying to shed some light, some hope, some direction about asking, you know, call your primary care up and make an appointment. Nowadays, you don't even have to go in the office. You could probably do a telehealth appointment with your primary care. And, you know, if you're too stressed out, you know, but, you know, typically I've just seen people able to function better. Anxiety doesn't help us smile. You know, anxiety we can feel real mired down with barbed wire with anxiety. And it definitely is a bully, for sure. Yes, there's neuro, chemistry going on, but it can make us feel defeated. It can make us feel exhausted. It can make us feel, especially those of us who are worry warts or, you know, have had things happen to them in the past and, you know, and have reoccurring, you know, situations that come up that deeply affect them. And again, that comes back to the, what would a sensible person do, right? What would a sensible person do in this, you know, reality testing?
The reasonable person hypothesis.
The reasonable person hypothesis. So I encourage you to get help. And that is why and how the medications work, is that people, if they have enough on board that assuages an amount of anxiety that helps them to function better and they can see and work toward goals, treatment goals, real treatment goals that matter to that person, whether it's, I just want to be able to get in my car and drive to the grocery store. A lot of people I worked with had fear of going to the grocery store, and that was before the pandemic, or fear of driving on the highway, or, you know, fear of, you know, war. So, I mean, there's fear of public speaking, but, and Jerry Seinfeld, and I'm going to ruin this quote too, but can you stir the soup? Jerry Seinfeld was so funny in one of his stand-up routines, which was on VHS, believe it or not. I'm dating myself, but it was called I'm Telling You for the Last Time. It's
on Netflix or Hulu.
Oh, yeah, I guess you can get it on Netflix or Hulu. It's brilliant. It's just the best. But I think in that stand-up, he talks about how, you know, the two biggest fears people have is public speaking and death. The second is death. So he says that means you would feel more comfortable, less comfortable giving the eulogy than being in the casket or something like that. I don't know. It was a lot funnier when he said it. But to say that too, people are afraid to die. People have hypochondriasis. I am a survivor. I was a hypochondriac years and years ago. I am a recovered, but there's still stuff there. You know, I don't know. We're all so afraid to die. But it comes down to control. We can't control so many things, but us humans who try to control things can almost make our anxiety worse. And I mean, I want to come back and just kind of leave this. And I'm sure I forgot a million things. And of course, I didn't mention a million medications that could also help. And I, you know, whether it's sleep meds or whatever, you know, looking at things too from a perspective, like if something comes up, asking yourself, is this a 5-second problem? Is this a 5-minute problem? Is this a 5-hour problem? Is this a 5-day problem? Is this a 5-week problem? 5-month problem? 5-year problem? Oh my God. So I use that tool a lot for myself. And again, being around people that levitate you, that make you feel good about yourself, that are kind. Spirituality is a no-brainer. People who are spiritual do better. You know, handing things over to a greater power sometimes can make people feel a tremendous amount of relief. They give up the control and then they sit back and say, okay, it's in God's hands now. You know, really, I mean, looking at AA, that is all about handing something over to a power that's greater than you, and AA works. And I'm a, you know, big fan. I'm not in it, but I do know that it helps a lot of people. But yeah, just kind of checking in, you know, with the war going on in Ukraine, it's been a very, you know, just like the pandemic, uncharted waters, and the war in Ukraine, I think, is weighing on a lot of us and a lot of us who feel pretty helpless, knowing that another part of the world, that there's, you know, genocide happening, and it's deeply, deeply disturbing. And I think that just like the pandemic, it exacerbated anxiety. The already anxious person is going to feel even more anxious because, and then you look at the global and then you look at the world. But coming back to how to take care of yourself in a healthy way, sometimes that means taking care of yourself in a new way. You know, maybe, you know, drinking less alcohol. I mean, you got to figure out what can I do. Maybe I can go for a walk. You know, maybe walk with a friend, call someone you care about, give back to other people. Just as long as you're not that person that just keeps giving and giving and giving, though, you know who you are, those people. You need to probably give less and have better boundaries and, to protect yourself from being taken advantage of. So, but I do think taking care of other people, doing something nice, I can't even say random acts of kindness. And in this world, we learned it in the pandemic. It can look like a very dark place and a very cluttered place and a very confusing place. But in, I brought up social media earlier today because that can cause a lot of pain. People, you know, just looking on things like Instagram, you could go crazy. I mean, looking at like, you know, people who are perfectly physically fit and, you know, famous and, oh, don't they have such a great life? Well, most of us know that that's usually not the case. Everybody has their stuff. But, you know, that being said, there's also random acts of kindness that you can observe. And there are people doing really wonderful, amazing things in this world. So as a human, we have to accept, too, that to be human is to suffer. And people suffer because they're human. Because people who are happy and in a happy moment, who else feels like this? You latch onto it. You don't want to let it go. And once you try to latch on to joy or anything that like that, that's when the suffering comes in. Because we just want more of it. We just want more of it. And I just think that that's the human condition. And I think we're all human and we all have our stuff. And I think a lot of times people are misguided, but I feel like people who reach out to us, God bless you. We love it. Please feel free to reach out to us anytime. But a lot of people who struggle with things going on in their headspace really feel alone. And I pray that this stigma goes away. But, you know, sometimes people just don't want to share how they feel. And sometimes how they feel is not obvious. So that being said, I know I'm rambling today. I apologize, but thank you for listening to me. I hope it was helpful, and please don't hesitate to email or ask questions, and please give us anything you'd like us to talk about. Happy to do that. Any topics that we need to focus a little bit more on, but I think anxiety is always a hot topic. I wish you well, be kind to yourselves and be kind to others, and God bless you.
He went on and on there.
That was good, though.
Yeah, so I think Julie brings up really good points. Talk to prescribers. Talk to your therapist. If you're not in therapy, please get into therapy. And I say this, not going to be surprised, and Julie even espoused the same thing. Please get a full neuropsych eval, because you need to really figure out is if it's major depression, major depressive disorder, or is it bipolar disorder or they were called like bipolar depression. Two different classes of medications, very different types of treatment. But anxiety, again, I wanted to do this because it's pervasive throughout everybody that I diagnose. It's pervasive in the very small amount of individuals that I treat. Cognitive behavioral therapy is the key. And again, the research is shown over and over again, cognitive therapy, psychotropic medication is the most effective are the most effective pathways in conjunction with each other for the vast majority of all the psychiatric conditions. So it can be incredibly debilitating, but it could also be something that you can't overcome. I hate the word normal, but again, as I said, take a look. Is some of the anxiety that you're experiencing like, yeah, this is kind of a situation where most people would be anxious? Or is it getting to a point, like Julia said, where you can't even drive to the grocery store because it's so incapacitating? And it can get to that level. It seems so innocuous. And sometimes people think, you know, the whole big one of the reasons of doing this podcast was to demystify mental health, legitimize mental health, instill a sense of hope. But anxiety is something that it's not as easy as just take a deep breath. You know, just go for a walk. Even though Julie goes for walks, I'm just saying sometimes people really dismiss people with anxiety, thinking if it's just that simple. Same with like depression. Like just you know, take a shower and go out. It's not that easy. It's not that easy. You know, parents with their kids, like just snap out of it. You know, severe like separation anxiety, which is, you know, related very much to attachment styles, which is related very much to borderline pathology, borderline personality pathology. Anxiety is not something that you can just snap your fingers and it goes away, but it can be effectively treated, ameliorated, reduced, and really you can regain control of your lives. So thanks again for listening. As I say, you know, I feel this is just my modest version of God's work. I'm going to have a few guests on. One in particular is an individual who wrote a book, about her journey of being addicted to benzodiazepines. And I'm going to have her on because I'm just finishing her book and it's excellent. I think it'd be good to hear a firsthand perspective. So much appreciation to all of the people who follow us. And as Julie said, you can always email us with suggestions and topics. And questions. I'm getting the emails and the phone calls and the questions. So you can get a hold of me through Psychology Today, psychologyunplugged at outlook.com. So my number is 617-750-941 East Coast Standard Time in the United States. Until next week, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Get yourself into therapy. Get tested. Ask questions. And I guess that's it. Bye, guys. Be well.